The bit that they're missing is that Bitcoin is just energy money. It's like the purest form of money there is.
It's going to be messy. Let's just, you know, try to get as many life rafts out there for people as possible.
So we take the big red button away, you can fix the money. When you fix the money, you fix the world.
Like, what do you think the end result of this is going to be? Like, you kick this can far enough down the road, eventually it has to blow up. There's a cause and effect.
All the good work that the Doge team are doing in the US to root out this corruption and, you know, waste and spending, it's only temporary. It doesn't change anything.
I think there are a lot of people who could have made the exact same video and it just wouldn't have landed the way that it does. It wouldn't be something I want to send to someone like my mom or you know, many other people in my life. So kudos to you.
You know, it's been very clear to me for a couple of years now that there's nothing more important than helping Bitcoin win.
Hey there, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Joe Bryan. He is the creator of the viral Bitcoin video, What's the Problem? Had a great conversation with him. He knows way more than he just shared in the video, so we covered a lot of topics. I think it was really fun. He's been on a handful of big podcasts talking about the video and the nature of that project, so I think it was a lot of fun just to explore some other areas. I'm a bit under the weather, as you can probably hear, so hopefully it doesn't interfere with the podcast itself, but you're going to really enjoy hearing from Joe on this one. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Joe here. Joe, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We need a lot more content like this, but I think you have absolutely nailed the What's the Problem video. We're going to get into that. I want to start with something. This is just like a curiosity I have. My sense, based on the video that you've produced, all the noise it's made in the space, and people are very excited about this video. It's an unbelievable orange pill tool. I'm curious, as someone who's thought through so many of these things, probably talked to a lot of people about Bitcoin, what is the most frustrating objection that you get from no-coiners, from the world of TradFi, anyone who's not into Bitcoin or a skeptic? What's the most frustrating objective you get, and how do you respond to it?
I think there's a few.
You list as many as you like.
There's a list, and you have it's not backed by anything.
Yeah,
which opens up, you know, that's not a short answer,
right?
To explain
right.
Why that's A, wrong, and B, doubly wrong. When they're thinking about the things that they think are backed by something. So it's, you know, their starting point, they feel like they're building on, they're talking down from the top of the mountain. But if actually, you know, they're on the ground and Bitcoin's on the mountain, it's, you know, wrong on two counts. So that's the first one. And then secondly, that deflation is terrible. You know, building on that, inflation is good.
Yeah. And so what's your response then?
So let's take the first one first, I guess. You know, it's not backed by anything. And then the very first question is, well, what is the current system backed by as a starting point? You know, some people think it's backed by gold and something is backed, you know, by some mystical force. It's the government. I was like, well, you know, what is that? And we drill into that. But then the bit that they're missing is that Bitcoin is just energy money. It's like the purest form of money there is. And to go from the realization that fiat is just by decree, that it's not backed by anything at all, to the chain of thinking that ends with Bitcoin is the soundest money on the planet because it's backed by this energy and it's neutral, takes a little bit of time. But you really have to walk them through the evolution of the fiat system and why gold was ultimately landed on as the hardest form of money. And then how Bitcoin is the natural extension of that, is the culmination of that hard money journey. but you have to fill in the gaps along the way, you know, and we could do that, but it takes a little bit of time. If you want to do that, we can do that.
No, we don't have to dive into the details. I'll tell you, one of the more interesting explanations I've read is Parker Lewis's Gradually Then Suddenly. And he said, you know, Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. And what he concludes is that Bitcoin is backed by the credibility of its monetary properties. And that's really what, like when you tell the story of gold, that's really what you're doing is you're saying there, here are the properties of a good money. And you talk about it in the video and we'll get to that. Energy is what secures the network and all these things. But I think it's sort of abstract for people to try imagining Bitcoin being backed by energy. Like, what does that mean exactly? But if you say if you're able to just articulate, it is scarce, it is censorship resistant, it's permissionless, it's all of these things. Isn't that the type of money you'd want? Yes. And like, isn't that the type of money that humans landed on with gold, or at least, you know, to the best of their ability?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's for those, some of those properties are broaden the qualities of gold. And so, you know, I tend to get people to the point of why do people use gold, or why was gold considered the best form of money before fiat was laid on top, and then get them to think about the production of gold. And so the gold supply is not fixed. Gold is hard money with soft edges. It's the hardest money we had pre the digital age. And all the gold that's ever been mined still exists in one form or another. But gold is effectively infinite in the planet, to all intents and purposes. We just can't get it. And it's definitely infinite in the universe, right? We just can't get it. And so what happens is, in order to produce more gold, you have to expend energy. You have to get it out the ground. And so you are using a really inefficient form of energy money. You have to expend energy to get it out the ground. And but the difference being, and this is where it links into the monetary properties, is when the price of gold goes up, the supply goes up. Because the gold companies raise capital, can now dig out deposits that were previously uneconomical. But now the gold price has gone up, are now economical. And then they can bring more supply to the market, which increases the supply and drives the price down. And so you have a low but very variable monetary policy for gold. But you also have to expend energy in a really inefficient way to mine it. So gold already was sort of really poor energy money.
Right.
So what's the natural next step? The natural next step is to have a purely digital form of money, which also has peer-to-peer and censorship resistant and all of these things, which, you know, gold is not, or is to some, you know, analog degree. But it's really the culmination of the perfection of energy money.
Mm, yeah.
And when you lay it like that, it becomes a much more logical step for them. Like, okay, I can understand how one becomes the other, and it becomes so much better. It's not just the perfection within energy efficiency and security and fixed monetary policy. It has all these other benefits, like censorship resistance, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so agree with Parker Lewis, but those things then sort of flow back down to why you would go from gold to Bitcoin in the first place, just through a natural evolution of thinking.
Right. Yeah. Well, what was the second question you said that frustrates you?
The second question was deflation is bad. Right. You know, prices need to go up, or inflation needs to exist for growth, for economies to grow, and for economics to work, which is just so clearly false.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have that single slide in the video where you're on the island, and they're figuring out how to become more productive, and then they specialize, and then they start trading and investing with each other. Just simple, very simple example of why prices naturally go down, because technology is deflationary. That's the natural state of the world. But the starting point for many people, and this tends to only really be the people who have some level of formal background in economics, right? Because then they think they understand how this works, because they've been taught, they've had Keynesian stuff forced down their throat, or they are very trusting of the government and the central banks to think that inflation is this natural thing that you can't control. You know, one of those starting points is much easier to dismiss and to reconstruct. The other depends on the combination of the explanation and the ego of the person listening. Right. And I could do something about one, I can't do something about the other. And so, you know, some people retain their view in the face of logic. But, you know, Bitcoin is an ego test first, and that extends as far as, you know, thinking about how things work in the free market with perfect money and so on.
So why don't you, we're going to get, by the way, do you call it a video or a documentary, or what, how do you think of your project?
Just video, but people have called it, you know, film and stuff like that, which sounds far too grand. yeah.
Well, before we get to it, why don't you, could you give like just a bit of a background on yourself? I think you have an interesting story, and maybe even talk a little bit about what brought you into Bitcoin, and what inspired you to begin this journey of trying to figure out a way to orange pill the world?
I'll start at the end first. I didn't really decide to go on an orange pilling mission. It just sort of happened. I'm delighted it has happened, but it wasn't a plan. It's sort of more accidental. I'm just glad it's been helpful to everybody. The first part is, you know, my background was physics, and then I became an equity derivatives trader for 10 years, and then left to move into start my own business in modeling sports. So I'm trying to calculate the probabilities, things happening in sports events, and we built an automated trading and pricing business, which supplied bookmakers, and we got acquired, and then we grew that business. And then in 2024, I took a step out to focus entirely on Bitcoin, because in 2020, I found Bitcoin, along with many others during that, you know, very tumultuous period. And, you know, conviction builds over time. And, you know, it's been very clear to me for a couple of years now that there's nothing more important than helping Bitcoin win as quickly as possible, because it's going to win anyway. Just the quicker it can win, the better it is for everybody.
Because maybe we'll talk about it, but, you know, I think a lot of people are expecting a lot of calamity, a lot of chaos over the next decade. Do you think that if Bitcoin can win sooner, that, you know, we can onboard more individuals, families into Bitcoin, do you think necessarily means a smoother transition and less chaos? Or do you think we're still just going to have a massive cohort of people who are late to the game, and a lot of, you know, because I guess I can see a world where we get enough people on Bitcoin, people opt out voluntarily, and if we can get 80% of, you know, the world onto a Bitcoin standard before, you know, everything melts down, you know, we could maybe have a smooth transition. Or are you sort of anticipating, hey, it's going to be messy, let's just, you know, try to get as many life rafts out there for people as possible?
I'd break it into several parts. Some people are always going to be resistant, and not enough people will have engaged with Bitcoin before we reach the tipping point. That's just sort of by definition, because you'd have reached the tipping point earlier if they'd engaged. And so,
sure,
you know, it's sort of an unavoidable one. But I think to zoom out, Bitcoin is not precipitating the mess. The mess is happening independent of Bitcoin. Like, imagine how we would all feel if Bitcoin did not exist.
Yeah.
I mean, I would hate to be in that world, because the financial system is being destroyed. The central banks are stealing the wealth from everybody. And there would be no way out. There's nothing you can truly own in the world apart from Bitcoin. Everything right. else is involves a promise from somebody. And so it's the only asset. Now, because you do have Bitcoin, is it going to precipitate an acceleration in the change that we're on the verge of seeing? Then absolutely. But also it makes that transition a lot better, in my view. In my view, because people, the people who do engage with it are the most productive people, the critical thinkers, the people who can then drive and affect change. And because it's a voluntary system, the people who do engage with it see the change that happens in their own lives when they do. And they want to share that with other people. Which means you have a very welcoming life raft for to try and help everybody else on board. And productive people who can affect meaningful change to help drive it. That's a very, very positive thing against a very dark backdrop of central bank theft. And so, you know, any transition to a Bitcoin standard over time is going to be a gradual one. It will be gradual, and suddenly, but it won't be the suddenly when we've reached 80%. It'll be the suddenly when we've reached a very low percentage of people, because it will be the people, it will be the decision makers who have made the jump.
It's an interesting way of framing it. Yeah. Because we talk a lot of times at Bitcoin about how it's just such an interesting, productive, sort of inspired group of people, right? Like these early adopters, you know, like the team I work with at the Bitcoin Way, and so many people I've met at conferences, and that it's just something unique about the group of people who have figured it out thus far. And I think you're onto something, that it's going to be the people who they won't just have influence because of their financial abilities, you know, due to Bitcoin, but rather the type of people they were if Bitcoin didn't exist, you know, builders, producers, you know, thoughtful, critical thinkers, I think is a really interesting way of framing it.
Yeah. So if you then give those people additional capital,
mm-hmm.
because Bitcoin gets adopted and scales, they become increasingly wealthy and increasingly effective in driving that change across the rest of the population as well, which is, you know, I think the natural outcome of this technology adoption.
Yeah. So let's talk about the video, the documentary, the film. Why don't you? So I think the way you've gone about this is genius, because I think people like stories, and you crafted a story, and sort of in the midst of it, you tease out the nuance of the cause and effect of the different ways that this island, has gone about adopting money. Why don't you sort of explain the story of the video, what's going on, and then we'll kind of dive into, because I'm curious to hear, like, what I can only imagine some of these were very challenging bits to think about. How do I explain this in 5 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever? So why don't you tell the story generally, like the approach you took, and then we'll jump into some of the rest of it.
Well, I wanted to build something that was accessible to anybody who would watch it. And so it needed to not presuppose any information other than, you know, having basic understanding of how the world works from, you know, life experience, even if you're very young. But the idea is the island is, there's a shipwreck, and people, lots of smart people get washed up on a deserted island and reconstruct society. And they decide to discuss the characteristics of whatever monetary system they're going to use, but they agree amongst themselves on what they consider to be the properties of perfect money. But then there's a disagreement, and one of the guys on the island says, we all agree on that, but what if there's an emergency? I think we need a big red button that we can press and change any of those characteristics if we need to. Of course, no one will ever press it. And, you know, he's called Fiatello. And you have, because I had fun with the naming, because Fiatello didn't exist. But apparently it's slang for bad breath in Italian, which just makes it a little bit funnier. But Fiatello, and then Satoshi is the other leader who steps up and says, well, we don't need a big red button because it's already perfect. But the characteristics of the money, and because the characteristics, they're never going to change. It's just a truth. And so they can't agree, and so they build a big wall down the middle of the island. And then the rest of the video is really just seeing how the two sides of the island evolve through the eventual temptation that Fiatello succumbs to in pressing the big red button and starting to print some extra money for the government. And then how that spirals out of control and further out of control, meaning that he then erodes another characteristic of the perfect money, which is the censorship-resistant nature. And when he does those two things, we end up in a world like today with all of the issues that we have today. And it becomes very clear to people watching that the world we experience around ourselves is just downstream of corrupted money. And it's in stark contrast to what we see on Satoshi's side of the island, where there is no ability to compromise the quality of the money. And therefore, you take occasional short-term pain because you can't bail yourself out. It improves decision-making, but it ultimately improves quality of life for everybody, because you start to see prices going down and quality of life rising for everybody, and long-term investment driving sustainable growth, which is absolutely not the case on Fiatello's side of the island. And so watching it, I think people are finally able to connect the dots. They're able to understand what the world should look like and compare it to the way the world does look like. And they understand the reason why. And it's just because there's a big red button. That's all it is. So we take the big red button away, we can fix the money. If you fix the money, you fix the world. Like, it really is. It really is that simple. Now, clearly, there's a lot of abstraction there. There's a lot of abstraction behind the big red button, but it's a nice story that people can then, they will remember the story and they will tell their friends about the story, rather than, you know, in a way that they wouldn't remember a lecture or a technical video or something like that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You hit on something interesting, though, and it seems like because of what we've done is going down the path of Fiatello in the United States and really globally, nobody is conditioned any longer to experience that short-term pain, because you're going to have a natural disaster. You're going to have, you know, like something, I mean, we live in a world of chaos. Something's going to happen where you're going to experience short-term pain regardless. But it's, who's the guy? He's like one of these, who's the Bridgewater capital?
Dalio, Ray Dalio.
No, not Bridgewater. Sorry. There's a guy who, like, as soon as the market drops, he's on CNBC and he's like, they got to lower interest rates, and we got to, like, he's like always yelling for, like,
sounds like Trump at the moment.
Yeah. But it's like, they're so accustomed to just up and to the right, you know, especially the wealthy, that, like, the minute their asset prices are affected, it's like, well, we've got to do something. It's like, what do you think the end result of this is going to be? Like, you kick this can far enough down the road, eventually it has to blow up. There's a cause and effect. Just because the effect is delayed, and maybe you're lucky to get to die before it happens.
It's a feature of the system. It's a feature of the system, though, Michael, because the reason they can't, we cannot allow a free market in asset prices. Because asset prices are not allowed to fall. It's not that we don't want them to fall and people want them to continue to go up so they get richer. It's that we can't allow them to fall. Because if they fall,
Can you explain that?
Yeah. If they fall, they wipe everything out. because we're on a debt-based system. And because of fractional reserve banking, we end up having liabilities which far outstrip the underlying equity base of the banks. And if you're stacking leverage and the assets against which the leverage is secured go down, and you're super leveraged, the assets aren't allowed to fall even more than a small amount before you become insolvent. And so every time the market does fall, everyone's looking at the central bank to print more money, to loosen financial conditions. Because if they don't, the system implodes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get near the edge and things start to break, it's the weakest participants get washed out first within the banking sector. And typically they will then get sweetheart deals to be acquired by the bigger players in the financial system, where the government will underwrite the downside of the acquisition. The banks will keep the upside of the acquisition. And then you get further consolidation in the banking sector. And now the bank that acquired them is even more central, is even bigger, and even represents more of a systematic risk to the financial system than it did before. And now it knows next time there's any sort of wobble in the asset prices, they know exactly what the government and the central bank are going to do. They're going to bail them out again. Right? So you get this centralization over time where people know there's no downside risk, or the downside risk is capped because they'll just pick up the phone to the central bank. And so it's not a free market in money, and therefore it's not a free market in asset prices with the combination of the fractional reserve banking system. And so the whole thing is skewed. The whole thing is skewed. But there's no solution. The only solution is more money printing and more debt. And when you roll that forward, it's just the dollar's going to zero. Because each time that happens, there's more leverage, there's more debt. You can weather a smaller and smaller reduction in the asset prices before things start to crack. So you've got to print more and more debt. This is why you see the money supply in the US and the US government debt go exponential. You just hit the big red button every time, and every time the check is bigger. And the natural outcome there is the dollar just becomes worthless. The dollar will become worthless after everything else becomes worthless. They still become worthless. And so you've got to find something to own that protects you and takes you out of that system. And Bitcoin is the only thing.
Yeah, because even gold is so financialized at this point. Like physical gold might be, you know, a half-baked solution with obviously all of its flaws that Bitcoin doesn't have. But at this point, like even the gold bugs, that, you know, who are the Peter Schiffs of the world, they're pushing for, you know, centralized gold, certificate IOU. It's like, how do you think we got into this mess in the first place on a gold standard? Like that's the beauty of auditable every 10 minutes, you know, like everything that Bitcoin is, like it checks those boxes and eliminates the problems that a gold-backed monetary system has to begin with. The only solution is to push the big red button. Do you completely write off any opportunity for austerity, some sort of clever tax scheme, just fiscal responsibility? I mean, do you, when you say that, is the only world that you could envision more money printing? And if so, is that sort of philosophical, or is that you just look at the math and you say, you know, we just can't raise the taxes, we can't, you know, what's your take?
Maths plus human behavior. Let's say you could get it under control. It takes a brave politician. Right. A brave politician to say, now we need to take the medicine. And if they do that, they're not getting reelected.
Right.
They're not getting reelected. And who wants to be the guy who made everyone take their medicine? Nobody wants to be that guy. The people who want to be that guy appear after 50 years of socialism, where people are like, the status quo is so painful, I want the medicine. Right? I know it's going to be more painful in the short term, but I'm voting for the guy because he's bringing the medicine. We are so far from that point.
Right. Like,
that's just not achievable whatsoever. The only way to take the medicine and to cure the problem is to remove the big red button. Because even if you go in and say, well, we're going to have austerity, the big red button is still there. As soon as you leave, the next guy comes in, he gets a call from his mates at the bank, we need a bailout, presses the big red button again. If the button is there, it will be pressed. And so this is why, you know, despite, you know, all the good work that the Doge team are doing in the US to root out this corruption and, you know, waste and spending, it's only temporary. It doesn't change anything long run. It's like doing a spring clean in the house. You know, you have to do it every year because it just gets dirty again. It's the same thing is going to happen. There is no solution but removing the big red button. That's it. And when you have a debt-based system, then you have to just keep printing money or else it goes bankrupt. So there is no way out.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree with you. I'm just always curious because I've talked to people, particularly like financial advisors, people who probably don't have a strong grasp of the macroeconomic picture, who in their heart of hearts seem to believe that there's some solution that doesn't cause 15% inflation year over year or what have you. And I don't see it either.
There's two things. You remove the big red button, but you can't do that on the dollar. You can only do that with Bitcoin. It's the only way. And so the only way out is to adopt Bitcoin, is to migrate to a Bitcoin system. And this is what is slowly dawning on the US.
Do you think politicians are waking up to that? Or like there are a lot of people who are trying to piece together right now. Does like Scott Bessent is Trump maybe figuring out that this is a disaster on our hands and we need Bitcoin? Or do you think
I think it's the will, and this is a personal view, people would disagree.
Yeah. No, go for it.
But the world is changing. In real time, most of the world hasn't woken up to it. Right, but the monetary order is changing as we look at it. It's probably a bit too early to go directly to Bitcoin. I think, but you can start to deleverage using Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the solution to the solvency crisis for the US. The US is insolvent in real terms. They can print as much money as they want to pay back the debts nominally, but they're insolvent and they've put other countries around the world in a really tough spot because they've undermined their legitimacy of the treasuries because of how they treated Russia. So anybody who holds the treasuries now thinks, are these treasuries actually reliable? Or if I do something or say something the US doesn't like, suddenly I can't do anything with them and therefore they're worth zero to me. Right?
Yeah.
That undermines the treasuries. And so you've got the rest of the world looking at this paper they own, thinking this is probably not worth what we think it's worth. And the US at the same time struggling with the realization that it is insolvent. We just have to look at the charts of the debt and the M2 supply. It's going exponential. And there's no way out. There's a structural deficit of a couple of trillion. You're 36 trillion in debt and you owe another 50 to 200 trillion. Like, there's no way to pay that. There's no way to pay that back. You can't tax yourself out of that. You've got to find some other way. And the only way is to recapitalize on Bitcoin. It's the only way. But to jump to a Bitcoin-based financial system now is too early, because the infrastructure's not there. It hasn't monetized sufficiently across the world's assets. But in my view, it will. It will. So I suspect we will go back to, we'll have a monetary reordering, which may include gold to some degree, as a stop on the way to the ultimate destination, which is a Bitcoin-centric financial system.
Do you have, so this isn't necessarily the direction I wanted to take this, but I'd be curious. You have a very strong grasp of I think everything going on. And one of my big concerns, I've railed very publicly now against the strategic Bitcoin reserve. Not necessarily, I think Bitcoin's for anyone. And so if any government, company, whoever wants to adopt it, the question for me is just, do I cheer it on or not? And I choose generally not to cheer on strategic reserves at the state level, nation state level. And the reason for that is I have this fear, and my question is going to be, is this an unfounded fear that I have, or is there legitimacy to this? I have this fear that, we've had a strategic gold reserve for a long time, and that has no impact on the money printer. Is having a strategic Bitcoin reserve, could they use this digital gold narrative to basically turn it into, to basically sort of suspend any growth, in its monetization, in Bitcoin's monetization at its digital gold? You store it in a vault, it'll go up in value because it's a scarce asset, and maybe more people will buy it, but it's not a medium of exchange, right? It's never going to be a unit of account. Because my concern is, can the money printer still exist even if Bitcoin is on the balance sheet of every nation state in the world? And the example I always use is, I fear that if nation states aren't buying fighter jets with Bitcoin because they still have a money printer, we don't end the forever wars. We don't see a healthier society. All of these things that we talk about that we want. Is that a legitimate concern, or is it going to win as a medium of exchange regardless? Like, what's your thought on that?
I would say it's a temporary concern.
Okay.
So the way I would think about it is, actually, Bitcoin is for anybody. And it is the logical thing for everyone to buy it. Everyone individually, whether you're a person, your company, country, right? Because of how we understand Bitcoin, the properties of Bitcoin, and therefore Bitcoin is the end destination for everybody. Now, if that is your realization, you wouldn't just put it on the balance sheet and not buy any more of it. You'd be trying to buy as much as possible. And when you start to buy as much as possible, it just accelerates the monetization of the world and demonetizes all the other stores of value. And so it doesn't just sit alongside gold. It replaces gold as your primary strategic reserve for a nation. But it doesn't remove the money printer. As you say, it doesn't remove the big red button. So it gives you a route to recapitalize your balance sheet as a country. It can improve your assets to debt ratio. Effectively, though, that would just be abused and allow you to print more money right over time, because you could run bigger deficits again, in nominal terms, because you've created assets on that side of the balance sheet. Right, because the Bitcoin price has gone up and you want more of it. And so it doesn't solve the problem. It's a route to a route back out of insolvency for countries. But the issue will just occur again. But what happens, in my view, is because Bitcoin ends up eating the world through monetization and adoption by individuals, companies, countries, we end up using it as the primary currency. Because no one can stop it. Right? We'll have a continued growth of tools and accessibility, et cetera, over time. You will see more and more countries trading with each other directly in Bitcoin, so they don't have to ask the permission of the US to make a transaction. Right? And the US is forcing countries in that direction. And so I think strategic Bitcoin reserves on the nation state level, whilst certainly not ideal from a Bitcoin perspective, you can't stop them. But they will, the primary outcome of them will be to drive Bitcoin adoption within the countries and to drive game theory, which means Bitcoin monetizes the world faster. And ultimately, people then don't want the dollars. They just want Bitcoin. Why would I want paper money when I can just have Bitcoin? And so you'll start to see, in my view, fiat currencies wither on the vine and people will just move to Bitcoin. And it'll be small countries first, and then eventually you may even just have the dollar left.
Do you think there's a risk of them being governments, probably the US in particular, trying to like peg the dollar to Bitcoin the way that they pegged gold to the dollar, you know, back in the day? And we talked a bit about the auditability of Bitcoin, but it still feels like there's, you know, I don't know, I just distrust anything government involves itself in. And so it feels like there's still an opportunity for manipulation. And do you think that's a risk, or do you think that people will, so like China and Russia are already trading in Bitcoin, as I understand it, with for energy, so like real commodities, like, you know, important stuff to have. Do you think that it's a stop along the way, though, where maybe we have a dollar pegged to Bitcoin to give people some, you know, give people confidence that the dollar actually means something, it is backed by something, they can't just print more of it? Or do you think it's going to be using the Lightning Network to buy your coffee? Like, because I still have my fear of CBDCs also, yeah. You know, and I'll let you talk on this for a second. How do you envision over the next 20 years this playing out? Like, what's the sequence? If you were to just lay out like a base case, you don't have to, I'm not holding you to it. You know, I know things change, but like, where we are now, and then 20 years from now, call it, what are we doing and what are the steps in between to get us there?
Well, that's a very big question.
It's a big question. I'm under the weather today, so you need to do as much talking as you can.
All right. Caveat this with, I'm going to be wildly wrong.
We all are.
I think the answer depends on where you are in the world.
Okay.
I would be much less worried about CBDCs where you are than where we are. The US is a bit, Bitcoin is freedom, and that aligns very well with America. It does not align well with Europe. Europe is about top-down control, centralization, and no individual freedom, and that's the direction of travel. UK is closer to the European end at the moment than the American end, but hopefully that's going to shift. And so in Europe, they're marching on with the creation of the CBDC. And they talk about it as being a potential, but they're already getting the things in place. And they've talked about October 2025 when they'll start building this thing. And so there's a fork in the road coming, whereas, you know, which way do you choose? Do you choose Bitcoin and freedom, or is it CBDC and tyranny? And if you pick the right path, you outperform massively. And if you pick the wrong path, you underperform to the point where you become impoverished and then have to join the freedom party late. Because like, everyone's going to be forced onto Bitcoin at some point. Because even with the CBDC, there's a big red button there. Apart from that, it's a big red button that does exactly what Fiatello did in the video, where it prints money and it removes all censorship resistance from your money, right? But it's on steroids. Like, your money now, it has an expiry date. You can only spend it on certain things. You say something you don't like, they delete it. That's the future of money in Europe, wrapped in a bow of ease of use. Right? Whereas you guys, you're in a much stronger position because you've already taken a step down that road for freedom and Bitcoin. You've ruled out central bank digital currency. You've got 4 more years of definitely not changing course. And Bitcoin is a competitive advantage. America will become the home of Bitcoin innovation the same way it became the home of internet innovation. And look at the amount of prosperity that unlocked for the US. And so the countries that embrace Bitcoin are going to outperform, do well, and potentially get themselves out of insolvency. The countries that don't are going to gradually implode. And so I think in the very long run, everybody ends up on Bitcoin. But I think for the next God knows how many years, we'll be moving toward a dollar and Bitcoin symbiotic relationship with the US remaining preeminent in the world, in part due to its embrace of Bitcoin.
Okay, interesting. So you think to some extent, Bitcoin does extend the lifespan of the dollar, but hopefully it the incentives that it drives maybe help keep what the dollar becomes in check to some degree. Would that be a fair way of reframing?
Yeah, I would say even if it got the dollar returned to the gold standard right now, you'd still have a big red button. You can just break the promise whenever you want. Exactly what happened before. It's not the solution. It's a sticking plaster. It's a sticking plaster when no one trusts the dollar anymore. No one trusts fiat anymore. You move back to something harder. But very quickly, once Bitcoin has done its next leg of monetization, then you begin to realize that Bitcoin is just the solution here, not gold.
Mm-hmm.
And, the US is in the leading position globally when it comes to Bitcoin. It has the biggest national strategic reserve, more or less, with China, which makes it a national security issue, is that they can't let the Chinese win. You've got the biggest company, biggest corporate holder in the world is an American company. You're the home. It aligns perfectly with the values of the US, freedom and free markets and capitalism. Yeah, it is the natural home for becoming the center of the Bitcoin world when it comes to adoption and business. And they may ultimately end up pegging it to Bitcoin at some point in time. But to your point earlier, transparency is questionable. Even if you have wallet addresses, you don't know where the wallets are. You don't know which wallet it is. It's the same way that, the ETFs currently are custodied. There's not proof of funds by default here. And maybe we'll get to a point where there's proof of funds on these things, but you'd have the same issue with the US government. And even in a pegged world, that's only one half of the puzzle. Knowing how much Bitcoin you have or how much gold you have in the vaults is only one half of it. The other half is how many dollars are out there. The US doesn't even know how many dollars it's printed with all the 14 money printers that Elon Musk found. So, even if you knew where all the Bitcoin was, you wouldn't know where all the dollars were. And so it's all just a promise. It's all just a promise until you remove fiat and you just use Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is everything. It's money, it's currency, it's the store of value, it is everything. You don't need anything else. And this is the realization that they're all going to come to naturally. It's just going to take a long time, because no one voluntarily gives up access to a big red button. Why would you?
Yeah. Yeah, the temptation is, and the political temptation, the power it brings is just too much. So you mentioned that at some point people start just demanding Bitcoin as payment. Do you think that to me that's I think of what your video outlines is the problem and the reason people are going to adopt Bitcoin, and I tend to just go in my head to they're going to realize, oh, I need to swap my fiat for Bitcoin. Like I get my paycheck and then I go buy Bitcoin at, you know, river.com or something like that. I wonder though, do you think that we're going to reach a point here in the coming years where maybe pretty quickly where people just demand being paid in Bitcoin? They say like, I need you to deposit Bitcoin into my wallet address, not, you know, pay my taxes and then, you know, take that out and then send me fiat into my checking account. Like, is that part of the transition you think that we're going to see besides just institutions and Wall Street and governments adopting Bitcoin?
I'd answer that with an example. Mm-hmm. If you're in Lebanon or Argentina, do you demand to get paid in pesos or Lebanese pounds?
I would think ideally not.
No. No, you say, you pay me in dollars.
Right.
If you're working for the government, they'll pay you in pesos or Lebanese pound. But if you're working for someone else, then it, you know, no thanks, you pay me in dollars. It's precisely the same reason, because you can't trust the currency. Mm. Even if you pay me in pesos or Lebanese pounds, I'm immediately trying to get them into dollars. It's no different. It's just the only slight difference is just the speed at which it's going to zero. Still going to zero. And for those people, they're willing, they want the pounds, but they want the dollars, because the dollar is seen as, it's their equivalent of hard money. Hard money with very soft edges. It's just that, you know, because their currency is entirely soft. So they'd be happy to lose 8-10% a year. That sounds amazing. That sounds a great deal. Whereas for us, losing 8-10% a year, we're like, this is terrible. It's all relative. It's all relative.
Yeah, we take it for granted that that relatively speaking, I think both of us are operating in stronger currencies. But it's still such a stark contrast, and that's why the importance of this wake up call that you're hopefully going to deliver to many, many millions of people in the work that you've done is it's like you have an option to not only not lose 8%, which today sounds good to you. You have the option to add 50%. You know, if you can store your wealth in something scarce, you know, censorship resistant, decentralized, but you also happen to figure this out early enough that, you know, we're not at this inflection point where now Bitcoin, you know, kind of grows at 3%, you know, because it's just globally, it's ubiquitous. And what a compelling value proposition. I think it's just, like I told you offline, just getting people to spend the time, you know, and like, you know, your video, I think is like, what, 39 minutes. And to me, that's no sweat, right? Like I'm listening to 2 hours of Bitcoin podcasts a day while I'm working out, driving, you know, doing whatever I'm doing. And so 40 minutes, as soon as someone sent it to me, I watched it and, you know, thought this is amazing. And I told you this morning, I passed it along to a bunch of other people as I was rewatching it in preparation for this. You know, I also take for granted, besides the strength of my currency, you know, it's not my currency, the US currency, relative to others, I take for granted the fact that I have time and that I can afford a hardware wallet and a lot of these things that, you know, I tend to think, you know, Tether and stable coins are, you know, CBDCs that just haven't been activated yet. Like that's something we tend to be very wary of. But I can imagine if you're in a third world country, if you're, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, barely getting by, it may just feel like the most expedient option that you have today. It's a tricky thing because it's all relative. You're welcome to comment on that. I have a question about the video. I know we've kind of gone a different direction. Yeah, I know
nice to have a chat about various stuff. So.
Yeah. I've heard you already on a few podcasts talking so much about the video. I think I'm going to make sure at the end we give people a send off to go find it, share it with everyone they know. But I think you're a smart guy who I think has a lot more to share than just here's the video I made, you know, over and over and over. One of the things you did talk about in the video, though, and you emphasized this as one of the properties of money, but again, it was emphasized, is the censorship resistance. And it says in the video, you hold it. Mm. And at the Bitcoin way, what we do is, if you're not familiar with us, we train people on taking proper 100% self-custody, no KYC, no counterparty risk, Bitcoin only, air-gapped, open source hardware wallets exclusively. Like, we don't just, can't just pick out your own and come to us and hope we'll teach you. Like, we're very uncompromising. Why was that the aspect of it of Bitcoin that you emphasized? And could you maybe elaborate on the significance of that?
Well, if it's not censorship resistance, it's just fear. You shouldn't have to trust anybody with anything. Bitcoin is the only thing you can truly own.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not censorship resistant, you don't have anything. And so it says, you know, Parker Lewis, he talks about the characteristics, the monetary policy itself, which is the thing that drives the value. But if it was censorable, it wouldn't be valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the peer-to-peer, no third party required aspect of Bitcoin, which is this, you know, transformation. And so, yeah, if you don't own Bitcoin in self-custody, you don't own Bitcoin, full stop. It's like having a share in a company. You know, it's just stacked on promises.
Yeah, the trustless nature really is, I think, probably underappreciated. Because even, like I think an absolutely scarce money is obviously optimal. But Bitcoin would still, with all of its other attributes, still be the best form of money, even if at the end of the day, it's still, there was still a 1% inflation on it. Because, you know, at least it's predictable, the monetary policy is set in stone. Like, the 21 million hard cap is beautiful, optimal. Obviously, I'm not, you know, in any way knocking that. But I still think with all of its other attributes, miners could continue to mine Bitcoin until the end of time, as long as it's at a sufficiently low rate. That below gold, say, you know, you could still have all these other properties and it's still the best form of money. I think you're right. So do you have concerns then with, like, Coinbase is becoming just a massive honeypot? I fear Fidelity and some of the, I think, BlackRock is diversifying into a new custodian for their ETF product. I just fear that, you know, a lot of the adoption, like, people are going to get rug pulled, maybe not even intentionally, but like Coinbase gets hacked, or maybe they are rehypothecating funds, or, you know, do you have concerns about that?
Or the government serves some of the notice.
or that. And then you learn what an IOU really is.
That's the big risk.
Okay. So you think it's government coercion of some kind?
You've got the technical risk of, you know, they get hacked or something like that. But I mean, that's true. That's true for everybody, however you store it. And, you know, I'm sure these Coinbase, et cetera, are taking, you know, high levels of precaution and best practices and these things. I would like to think so around storing all of these things.
Right.
In the same way that you guys are at the Bitcoin way. And so you've got to assume that they're taking precautions. But the thing you can't hedge against is a presidential executive order. Right? Mm-hmm. If you wake up tomorrow and you don't have any Bitcoin, you've got dollars in exchange for the Bitcoin, and all your Bitcoin's been handed over. You don't think BlackRock and all these guys wouldn't just, you know, send the money, send the Bitcoin straight to the government if they were told to do so? Of course they would.
Right.
So if you don't own anything. You own paper dollars again, which will then be massively devalued. So in a disaster scenario, and this is also why the US is in a preeminent position, because if the shit hits the fan,
mm-hmm.
you've got 2.5% of the Bitcoin supply at MicroStrategy. you've got another couple of percent of Bitcoin held in all the ETFs. Just do an executive order and just take it all. You're suddenly heads and shoulders the biggest Bitcoin holder in the world. Probably even more than Satoshi.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big risk. I'm not saying it's going to happen. But in the fullness of time, there's every chance. And so unless you own Bitcoin yourself in self-custody, you don't own it.
Yeah, it's so important. And like, I feel like we beat this drum. I mean, I know we beat this drum all day long because it's what we do. And it's the most important thing we think that anyone can do is take their Bitcoin into self-custody and do it the right way and not mess it up. But, you know, I've only been in Bitcoin 3 years, and it took me a year and a half, two years to like get off of BlockFi. I got lucky. I got out of there early enough. I didn't get wiped out. You know, before that, I had on Coinbase. Like, that was just the easiest place to buy it. It really took me a while to figure it out. And I fear there are still going to be a lot of people lingering in some of these IOU or custodial solutions that learn, you know, overnight what it means to not self-custody your Bitcoin. And
I would say, Michael, that self-custody is where everyone should get to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not where everyone starts. You may have a different view on this, but when I first bought it, it was on an exchange.
Yeah. Right?
And it's the same for most people, because that's the easiest. Often people find it without really knowing why. I think it's rare that people would do all the work on Bitcoin, become a Bitcoin maxi, and then go and buy some Bitcoin. It tends not to work that way around.
Right.
And so the ease with which you can access ETFs, especially in the US, in the UK, we can't buy your ETF. Apparently it's too risky. So, which is ludicrous. But opening it up to a much broader segment of the population means that more people get that first touch point with Bitcoin in terms of economic exposure. And then mm-hmm. a good portion of those will go down the rabbit hole and ultimately end up doing Bitcoin podcasts or something like that, you know, after 3 or 4 years. And you can bet your boots they won't be earning the ETF anymore, right? They'll have sold the ETF, bought Bitcoin, it'll be in self-custody. And so you can think of it like being the top of the funnel. The top of the funnel is now much, much wider than it used to be. And people need to go on that journey of learning, testing, making mistakes to come out the other end, knowing why they hold Bitcoin. And as a result, holding it in absolutely the right way. But that process takes time, as you know.
Yeah,
but sometimes it's hard, you know, because when you're down that path, looking back, you're thinking, well, why would anyone want to hold the ETF? But, you know, if you were talking to yourself 5 years ago, you'd be like, yeah, this ETF's great. You know, it's a big change in mindset, and we lose that. We lose that reflection sometimes, I think.
Yeah. Well, hey, I want to be respectful of your time. Do you have a few more minutes, or do you need to hop off? I've got a few more minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I agree with you. My fear of the ETFs specifically is that it might just become like this sort of passive recommendation that financial advisors you might well be right. This isn't something I'm going to argue on. I think that the ETF could be a piece of the top of the funnel. I fear that the ETF is probably less likely someone who gets interested and then tells their financial advisor, buy some the Bitcoin ETFs. And it's more like eventually the financial advisor is just passively recommend a 2% allocation or something. And so there's no real, it doesn't feel like skin in the game. It's the same way they might recommend a 1% gold allocation or, you know, whatever. I think the top of the funnel becomes content like what you've created, where, you know, people are just introduced to the concept of Bitcoin as it truly is and not as an IOU product. And I do agree with you. It's going to be KYC exchanges, you know, for most people. And I think that's fine. Like, we've got great relationships with River, Bitcoin Well, Relay over in Europe. You know, so I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You need to understand the trade-offs of KYC exchanges versus buying peer-to-peer. But, you know, I think people get there eventually, right? Eventually people are going to get paid in Bitcoin. And so they're going to have some level of, you know, anonymity, you know, that they don't know which check went to who, which employee or whatever. But I'm a little less sold on the ETF products maybe being an entry point into people being orange pilled, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it leads to a normalization of Bitcoin in the US.
Yeah, that's fair.
And so Bitcoin, it makes it easier for people to get exposure, but also it helps stamp out the misunderstanding or the perceived negative perception of Bitcoin wrongly held by sections of the population. So it's like, you know, if the US has a national strategic Bitcoin reserve and there's ETF products and my financial advisor is recommending I put 2% in it, maybe it's not actually just used by criminals. Maybe it's not actually destroying the planet. And so, you know, we have to turn people from negative to neutral before we can make them positive. And these things do have an impact on that as well, I would say.
I think that's a very fair position. I was thinking about this as I was watching your video again. I was thinking about, as someone who's deep down the rabbit hole, how hard it must have been to step back, you know, like really zoom out and think, how do I explain this to someone who is not down the rabbit hole at all? And I think it's maybe that's sort of the same struggle I have when I think about ETFs. And I see so much financialization of Bitcoin. I'm like, just buy and hold, and like, you know, you spend it when you can, spend and replace. Which maybe leads me to one more question about the video, because I hope you aren't disappointed that we haven't just talked about the video the whole time.
I'm happy to talk about all this stuff. It's, you know, I've done a number of podcasts now and people want to talk about the video, and that's great. But it's also nice to talk about Bitcoin in a wider sense. So no worries.
So what was my question about the video, though, is, and this could lead us down another rabbit hole, but what was the hardest concept to pull together and explain? You packed a lot of information into 40 minutes.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I would say there's nothing in there that's new. I can't take credit for the insights or anything like that in the video, because it's all come from other Bitcoiners. It's a repackaging of stuff that already exists. You know, all the great work that people have done, writing books, doing podcasts, educating others. I've been a beneficiary of that. And this is just another way to remix some of that into a story that helps other people. So there's no, you probably watched it and didn't learn anything. Rick, you probably didn't learn anything.
Good refresher.
Yeah, but it's true for most Bitcoiners as well, because this is just what's in our head in story form, and then a flowchart, and then it's a bit more story. That's all it is. It's just repackaging to make it more accessible. I would say the most challenging slide was trying to fit the cause and effect flowchart onto a single page.
Yeah. I thought you might say that.
Yeah, without overlapping any of the arrows. So that was, I can't tell you the number of pieces of paper I went through trying to figure out a way to do that. There were points where I definitely regretted starting it. trying to find a solution. But I could have put many other things on that page. Like, I didn't touch on education, for example. You know, there's a bunch of other maybe more controversial areas that I didn't touch, like energy and climate and these sorts of things, because I also wanted to make the video as politically neutral as possible.
Yeah.
And so anybody, whether they're left or right, could watch that and just get on board with it, because it's not a red versus blue thing.
Yeah, you did very good at that. I don't want to put more work on your plate, but I do have an idea for you. I think it would be cool to for you to explore some of those education and all of the, you know, health, all these sort of areas. I find it like, I think if people would get lost anywhere in the video, it would probably be the flow chart. I think you did a great job. I think most people will follow. I think it's easy when you haven't had like the repetition of like these cause and effect relationships between a lot of these things to kind of like, hang on, wait, why is the money printer? Why do we have an obesity, you know, epidemic yeah. because of the money printer? It's not intuitive until you've really like sort of molded over a bit. It would be interesting to kind of go through that exercise and like short form videos on each of these disparate topics where you're like, here's why our educational system is deteriorating. Here's why our health is deteriorating. Here are the perverse incentives around insurance. And, you know, like you could walk through a lot of them. And my sense is you have a very good grasp and a gift for sort of boiling it down, simplifying and coming up with it. But it's really hard. That's harder for me to explain to someone who I'm just talking to. Like I get it up here, but like to educate someone on that is sort of a challenge. So I would be, if you were ever open to making more videos, I think you could kind of go down some of these rabbit holes and probably do an incredible job. And it would make my job easier, you know, elaborating on things I've tried to explain.
Well, it's very nice of you to say, Michael, I have no plans to make any more videos. This video is for the community. The content is for the community. There is a website, satsversusfiat.com, where anybody can go and access all the materials. So you got all the slide decks, the speaker notes, the transcripts in 25 different languages, all put together by Bitcoin volunteers from around the world. And this is open to everybody. So maybe somebody's listening and they think, that's a good idea. If Joe's not going to do it, then maybe I'll do it. Have at it. This is great. This is a community effort. These materials are for everybody. And let's go and create more content and help make it easier to onboard the next, not onboard, bring the next group of people to the starting line with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It won't be me that does it, but hopefully somebody else will.
Yeah, I can only imagine the time and energy that went in on something like this. So I certainly understand that. But I think it's there's a lot of good content out there, obviously. And I know you probably pulled from much of that, but I think packaging it in this one neat place where I think people just, I can feel comfortable sending that. And if it's up to them, you can lead a horse to water, but if they're willing to drink, I think they're going to gain a lot from a 40 minute investment of time. And like I told you offline too, I'll continue my compliments. I think having a voice in Bitcoin, so many of us are so incendiary and fiery and, we're always fighting online with each other. I think having this slow, calming voice, politically neutral, I think is truly, I think there are a lot of people who could have made the exact same video and it just wouldn't have landed the way that it does. It wouldn't be something I want to send to someone like my mom or many other people in my life. So kudos to you. But I want to let you give a handoff here in just a minute. I got to ask you my final question that I ask everyone, and that is, what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners? So here's your chance to be divisive.
Self-custody is not the right first step for everybody.
Yeah.
And that might seem fairly obvious, but it will. Some people say, no, you absolutely should be doing self-custody from the very beginning. I think self-custody is where you should aspire to. But there's a trade-off in risk and reward and competency. And I think it's on us as a community to make the risk associated with doing that as low as possible through the tooling that we build. Because there's still a material gap. Still a material gap. And this is not just from a receiving side, it's also from a sending side. We still build tools and software for people who are assumed to have a certain level of understanding. And I think as the footprint of Bitcoin expands, and if we really want everyone to get to a position where they can take self-custody and then keep it safe, then, you know, we need to make some big advances in trying to strip away all the friction, the complexity, etc. over time. We're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
But, you know, I certainly wouldn't be comfortable with, you know, my mom buying Bitcoin and then taking self-custody of it. I'd be like, well, that's going to disappear. You know, but we need to get to that point. And so there is a level of pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to adopt.
Well, if you think about it, it makes sense, because if you think about it, your level of conviction to some degree is going to be correlated to the amount of Bitcoin that you have. And at some point it begins to make a lot of, your conviction is sufficiently high that you're willing to invest the time to learn to do it right. And like, and this is, again, like, you know, from our perspective, like, we're training 80-year-olds on how to run their own node, self-custody their Bitcoin. It's not rocket science, but you have to have the willingness to sit down, invest some capital and some time to learn how to do it right.
Yeah.
And everyone's at a different place on their journey, right? If you just went to Coinbase and bought your first Bitcoin, and, you know, like, you probably have some more podcasts to listen to, books to read, like to really grow in understanding what it is. Like, watching your video may tune people into that there is a problem. Here's what it is. Sounds like Bitcoin solves this, but it's probably not going to be the force that drives them 80% of their portfolio into Bitcoin, right? So it's like when you begin to make those steps, I think that's when it makes a lot of sense to look into self-custody and to do it the right way. Because if you come to us and you have 0.0001 Bitcoin and you just got in last week, you're not going to probably want to afford what we do. And, I certainly understand that. The quicker we can get people to that point, though, because I think it's less of a technical proficiency issue, because we are training people of all technical proficiencies, all age ranges. I agree it could probably get easier, but I think that the quicker we can get more and more people to that level of conviction that they're just willing to take the time and slow down and sit and learn, I completely agree. I think we're going to, you know, the world will be a better place when more people get there.
Yeah. And to be clear, I think we all should. That's definitely the end, right? Definitely the end goal. It's just, you know, sometimes, especially online, people see things very black and white, don't they? So
right.
Sometimes there is a little bit of gray in the middle.
Right. Yeah, certainly. Well, hey, you mentioned where to find the video, but reiterate that for everyone. Tell them where they can find you. Give any sort of handoff you want to give.
Well, the video is called What's the Problem? And if you haven't seen it already, even if you just Google What's the Problem? What's the Problem Bitcoin, or What's the Problem Joe Bryan? I think it appears now for all three of those searches, despite the generic terms on Google, which is great.
Love it.
If you cannot find it for some reason, just go to satsversusfiat.com, and that's SATSVSFIAT. So Satoshis versus Fiat. Satsversusfiat.com. And that's the same handle on YouTube, the website, and on X. Come and get involved, watch it, join the community on X, share it with other people, access the materials online, give the presentation yourself to friends, family. Share videos with people who live in different countries. You know, we've also got, I think, 5 different brand new videos done in native languages. So a French video with French slides. I'm still there in the back. I'm still there, but someone's speaking French. But the slides are inserted with the French slides, and so this is becoming accessible to everybody, not just its subtitles and on the English video. And you can find me on LinkedIn or X, and I'm Satmojo, SATMOJO. And just to reiterate, this is not a commercial thing at all, Michael, for me. So this is for everybody please feel free to help yourselves to the information, the materials, and just share it as widely as possible. And say hello.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Joe, thank you so much for your time. The gift you've given the community, I think, is people have struggled for, you know, many cycles now to figure out how to orange pill friends and family. I think this is an incredible gift to pass along and give people someone else to listen to explain Bitcoin and to do so well. So thank you. And I hope we can stay in touch. And if you're going to be at any of the conferences or anything, I would love to meet up at some point.
I'll be at Vegas.
Okay. Perfect. You're going to be in Prague?
I'll be at Prague as well. So,
okay. Let's meet up, have a beer or something, and we'd love to chat.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks, Michael.
Have a great day.
You too.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Joe. I know I sure did. Go check out satsversusfiat.com. Check out that video. It's one of the best orange pilling tools to send to anyone in your life. It is 40 minutes long, but if you can't get someone to read a 300-page book, maybe they'll spend some time watching a video. I think this is a great one to do. And if you need help with Bitcoin in 100% self-custody, as Joe and I discussed, this is an important step. If you're there, which most of the people probably watching this podcast should be, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast, schedule a free 30-minute consultation with a member of our team. We would love to walk you through how we help you do it the right way the first time without any compromises, no shortcuts, no KYC, no nonsense. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones, Plan B residency options, everything you need for your self-sovereignty life that you want to live. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Do me a favor, if you're enjoying the podcast, like or subscribe, comment on this video, share it with someone who you think might be interested. Would really appreciate that. And as always, until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.